you know, when you're an illustrator, you're as good as your last project. And also you're always going to be commissioned for what you put out there. So if you start doing, you know, bad work, or it's going to show, and it's going to bring, you know, bad quality work.
That's Malika Favre, and this is the On Design podcast. Hi everyone, and welcome to the new episode of the On Design podcast. I'm your host, Justina Green. I'm an illustrator, and I've spent the past 10 years in the design industry in various roles. On this podcast, as you know, every week we speak to the most exciting people in design right now. We learn what inspires them, how they work, and how they see the world. I'm super excited about today's episode as I speak to Malika Favre, who's a French artist currently based in Barcelona. I absolutely adore Malika's works and adore her now after we've spoken as well, and you will understand why. And I would say that her works are probably really, really popular because of the easily recognizable style that focuses on light, shadow, and the negative space. And her works, the resulting works, they're both bold and minimal, which is very interesting. And in our conversation, Malika shared with me her love for both maths and the arts. She recalled her move to London and start of her career. And also, what was really interesting to it's kind of in the second part of the conversation, we did dive really deep into Malika's philosophy around freedom and creativity, with plenty of advice on how to follow your heart and shape a fulfilling creative career. So there's absolutely plenty to enjoy. Here we go.
About taxes in Spain and how to set up your company. Yeah. Oh my God. Could do an entire podcast about that.
Yeah, probably lots of people will find it useful. Because I remember when you moved as well, you mentioned that there's a really nice community in Barcelona of creatives.
Yeah, a really nice one, actually. People were really welcoming. And it's quite a tight, I find it like to be quite a tight net of people. I mean, we haven't seen anybody for a year and a half anyway.
Yeah. How have you been finding it? Is it because I know that you traveled a lot with your work and for your work.
Yeah, no, and I used to travel a lot, and I really needed that for inspiration. So I guess, it changed a lot. I mean, I created a new Instagram account. That's what helped me to find inspiration elsewhere.
That's the one about, like, all the things you want to buy but you can't afford.
Exactly.
I love it.
Yeah, with my friend Jojo. I think it was, in a weird way, without really doing it consciously, it was a way to replace traveling. It was kind of a way to search for inspiration. And I've never really been one for following blogs, and, you know, I've always been quite bad at it and getting bored quite fast. But now it's like, it's so personal that, in a way, it's kind of, it's my daily research. And I think before, because I was traveling a lot, I didn't need to do it so much.
Yeah, because everything was just like right there in front of you, right?
Exactly. Yeah. In Mexico, in the market, and right now I've got access to, you know, seeing the same flat every day. So yeah, I guess I needed something to replace it. But yeah, no, I miss traveling a lot. I mean, it's been difficult. It's been difficult for everybody. I think all things considered, I'm extremely lucky because I was already working from home. You know, at the end, I remember the first lockdown was not that different from my normal life. You know, at the beginning, I was like, what's the big fuss about? I'm locked down. I'm locked in anyway. But I think it's more like mentally and it's difficult to kind of lose social contacts. And yeah, I found it quite, I found that I had so much time on my hands, but I was actually not very productive. I was extremely slow. That was my...
Did you find it that you had the time on your hands, but suddenly you just didn't know what to do with it because it's there and there's more of it.
Exactly.
And more of it.
Exactly. And you also, I think you also have the pressure of, I mean, you should be creating because that's all there is. You know, at the end of the day, you can't go out, you can't see friends, you can't... So there was this extra pressure of like, this is the time of your life where you should be the most productive. Also for this moment to kind of have a purpose. You know, and not just be like a year of limbo. But I think in the reality, it was much different. I mean, I did some things, but I did 10% of what I expected myself to do, and then I stopped expecting anything from myself. Much better since then.
Yeah, which is really good, right? Yeah, yeah.
But also, I think we're lucky in Barcelona. I mean, I'm really happy I did the lockdown in Barcelona. First of all, because it's sunny. I mean, and that changes mm-hmm. everything. You know, that changes your mood. We have a terrace.
That's bad, right? Yeah.
Yeah. No, it changes everything. And just to be able to get some fresh air by going on your terrace, or, you know, and it's, yeah, I think that was really important. And also, like, right now, it's a little bit less strict, I guess, than in England or in France. So, you know, we're still able to kind of go around. Small shops are opened. Restaurants are open at midday. So there is some kind of...
It sounds like a dream.
Yeah. No, it's not. Yeah, honestly, all things considered, it's not that bad. It was much harsher in the first lockdown, but now, yeah, now it's better.
Perfect. So we kind of started to where you're at now. And I thought, yeah. Why don't we take our listeners, like, all the way back where you're thinking about studying science, like you love science.
Down memory
lane. There's art.
Yeah, I know a lot of people are very surprised by that. But yeah, no, that's I mean, in a way, it's not that surprising growing up in France, I think, because I think the French education system is very elitist and it's very one-sided in a way. You know, it's kind of a one-track system. So either you're good at school or you're not. And when you're good at school, what you study is science. That's what you do. You know, this is the kind of the best option you can take for yourself, and the one that will give you the most option after high school, after the baccalaureate. So in a way, it's like I was good at science. I loved it. So, you know, I kept studying it. And yeah, I remember when I was 16, 17, I wanted to be an engineer. But I don't think I really wanted to be an engineer because I wanted to be an engineer, but maybe because that was the path, you know, I was on. Mm-hmm. And I could, and it kind of, if you could do it, this is where you would go. And also I found, you know, mathematics and physics to come quite easy to me. So I was like, oh, okay, I'll do that. You know, I understand it. It speaks to my brain. And also it felt like at the end of it, there was a job because, you know, in the 90s, there was a lot of unemployment and, you know, we grew up in that kind of atmosphere, you know, thinking even if you have like, you know, a master's degree, you might be unemployed. So I think, my mom was not working. She was stay-at-home mom. And my dad was studying. So he went back to studying when I think I was 10 or something. So he was studying mm-hmm. for 10 years and obviously not making a lot of money, you know, getting some help from the government and stuff. And so for me, the one thing I wanted was to have more money than my parents did. And, you know, I saw the struggle and so art was not even an option. It just wasn't an option. But because for me, it wasn't a job, just wasn't. So I guess this is why I went into, you know, prep school for engineering. And this is when things got really, really hard, like the, mm-hmm. you know, the level of difficulty and everything was. And this is when I realized, oh, my God, if I want this to be my job, I'm going to have to really commit to it. And it's at that point that I realized, actually, I miss literature. I miss art. I miss philosophy, like all these things you had in high school, because in science, you know, science class, you still add all these things. But then when I went into engineering school, it was math and physics and math and physics. And that was it. Like there was nothing else. And so that's when I thought, okay, this is not for me. I'm going to die here if I keep going. And I think I was 19 and I thought, okay, I need to give art a chance because this is the only other thing I felt I was good at. I was drawing since I was a kid, even though I never took art classes or anything. But, you know, as such, I was just drawing every day. So I was like, now that science is gone, what else am I good at? I was like, drawing. Okay, let's give it a shot. And so I went to study graphic design and advertising.
Yeah. And yeah. How did you feel when you started the graphic design course? Did you, like, as soon as you started, did you feel, oh, so that is the thing?
I know, I mean, yes and no. Like I knew, let's say I had an advantage because I could draw, I think, because I had drawn so many years and so much that technically I was good. One thing I was really bad at was having ideas. I wasn't thinking about what I was drawing. I was just drawing. And then all of a sudden, I had to find concept. I had to think about what I was going to do. So I think I was, in a way, I was good at drawing and I was pretty bad at the conceptual side, which I eventually learned. And no, art school was not easy for me. Like, it was fun. You know, at the end of the day, I did okay. But it was a bit of a struggle as well. It was a lot of work. And yeah, all these new things I had never done before. I couldn't just draw. I had to do volume, product design, and then photography, and a lot of things I was really bad at. But then this is where, I met a lot of friends from there, and it was exciting. At the end of the day, it was exciting. But back then I was really set on advertising. Again, I think mm-hmm. for the idea of I wanted to have a job, being an illustrator, yeah. not an option. So I wanted to become an art director in advertising. That was my dream. And, to have the kind of advertising dream of having a teammate and making loads of money and working for big brands. And I never worked a day in my life in advertising.
So how did that happen? So you had the big idea of advertising and you were studying at that point still in France?
In Paris, yeah. And yeah. What happened was really organic, something I didn't really see coming. Randomly, there was this teacher from Farnham in England that came to our school, on the last year. And our advertising teacher told us, oh, there is this guy from England and he likes the students from this school for whatever reason. He had a few in his school. And he's coming to Paris and he's coming to visit us. And if you want to show him your portfolios, maybe you could go study in England for a year. And we kind of went why not, why not? Could be fun. So we kind of decided with a few of my friends to do it. And actually the interview went really well. And the guy was like, yeah, come in. I'll take you straight directly into third year, of bachelor. And I was kind of like, huh. Okay, so I could, and I didn't want to work at that point. I didn't feel ready. I was like, I could go to England, study for a year in a place that looked out of a Harry Potter novel. There was a little student village with red bricks houses. And then you had to graduate and wear the hat. I mean, for me, it was just fascinating. And so that's how me and my best friend, we decided to go. And not knowing where it would lead us and thinking, we'll go for a year and then, we'll come back and we'll face real life. And we never came back. So we went there, we studied, and everything happened quite organically. For me, I got an internship at Airside, where I worked after. And I just fell in love. I fell in love with London. I didn't fall in love with Farnham. It was boring. But London was so exciting. And so that's when I realized I'm never going to come back. And the great thing about Airside is that this studio was kind of a graphic design and animation studio, but they were doing a lot of illustration. So I think also that's why I got the internship over there, because in a way I had this kind of mixed profile. And while I was in England, also at this school in Farnham, the way they were teaching was so different to France. It was the opposite of French art school. So it was like, do whatever you want to do, have fun. The kind of briefs were design a music, a CD cover, a vinyl cover, or for a band, or... And I was just like, are you crazy? You're giving us... it just felt really nuts. And so I think I during that year, I did a lot of illustration, a lot, because I could do it. They didn't care. They didn't want me to do graphic design. They didn't. So I think I built my first snippet of a portfolio that got me the internship. And then basically that's kind of when I started drawing more and using illustration for graphic design projects.
And that's kind of where your say style or the idea they start to meet, right? Whereas the graphic design and illustration,
yeah,
and but then the original concept as well.
Yeah, but I still wasn't strong at concept at that point. To be honest, I was just doing whatever I wanted to, I was very good at post rationalizing. That's something I learned in French school, finding a concept after I've actually done it, but. But no, yeah, when I went to Airside, my illustration style wasn't very defined. And I think that's probably why they hired me as well. It's like I could draw in a lot of different styles, really. So it was kind of, I could draw, I could adapt, and that's what they wanted as well. If I only had one style, probably I wouldn't have gotten in because we had lots of different clients. There was an overall aesthetic of simplicity and colors, and I've always had this colorful work, very curvy, you know, very neat. But really, I found my voice as an illustrator while working at Airside. It's kind of slowly mm-hmm. up there, you know, I stayed there for 5.5 years. And yeah, just slowly mixing, learning from them and kind of refining my aesthetic and producing personal work for their shop. So this is how, just over the course of 5 years, I kind of built my own portfolio. But again, without really knowing it, I didn't, even at that point, I didn't think I was an illustrator. And I never thought I was going to go freelance. It just happened.
And then is it at Airside where you first developed your first alphabet?
The Alpha Bunnies. That was there. I remember it was kind of a joint idea, these Alpha Bunnies, because I had my sketchbooks filled with naked ladies. So I was drawing naked ladies since I was 10. And of course the boys in the studio, I was the only girl designer at their side. And the boy in the studio, they loved it. It was a boys club and they were like, "Oh, Malika, show me your," you know, it was kind of like, it was funny. I was sharing my sketchbook. And I think one day I tried to kind of translate what was in my sketchbook, but in a much more graphic way and simplified way using negative space. And this is how I started drawing these bunny ladies. And one of the designers, I think it was Guy, at some point he saw what I was doing and he told me like, "Oh, it's funny. They actually look like letters." And so this is how the idea came. It just, okay, I'm going to do an alphabet. And so I did the entire alphabet. And then I presented it at the Monday morning meeting with the team because we could always present stuff for the shop that they could produce as screen prints or sculpture or anything you wanted to do. And they loved it. And they were like, "Okay, let's do a screen print. Let's sell it." And so this is how my first personal piece of work came, you know, ended up on blogs.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Yeah. And it sold out very fast. And then I started getting commissions, like Airside started getting commissions for that style. So
yeah, it's really brilliant. And then also, yeah, and kind of looking at where you're now, you know, now your Kama Sutra lettering has been animated and there's a book.
Yeah.
So the kind of the alphabet has gone kind of for a while as kind of as a thing.
Yeah, I think
right?
I did three alphabets in quite a short, in like 4 or 5 years. But I think the Kama Sutra alphabet, it was the last alphabet I designed. And it is an old project. It's my first project as freelance, actually. It was the first project I did when I left Airside. And now making the book last year, actually during the lockdown. That was kind of, you know, just to bringing closure to this, because I think when I did the Kama Sutra, I knew I had done my last alphabet. It kind of felt like, okay, I've done three. Yeah. This is the best one. And I've done it. I'm not going to keep doing it, you know, forever. But I always wanted to do something with these letters because they were the cover of the Penguin Kama Sutra book. And later I did an exhibition at Pick Me Up in London with all the letters, but I never did a project where I gathered everything together in something more tangible. And I knew I wanted to do a book from a really long time ago, actually. Back then I even pitched it to Penguin. You know, I want to do a book with all these letters, but they were like, "Yeah, what's the idea? We need more." And I think it took me a really long time to find that idea of like combining poetry and the Kama Sutra. And I'm really
happy.
Yeah,
and that's the book.
It happened. That's a book, basically.
Yeah, so that's the recent book, yeah.
Yeah, the book is a curation of 26, almost like haiku or little excerpts of poetry, erotic poetry, but like from, you know, from Shakespeare to contemporary poets. So it's kind of mixing all eras, and it was really fun. It was really fun to work on that and to do the curation and to read.
It sounds like an incredible thing, like you say, to kind of to wrap up the project.
Yeah.
And kind of and put it to bed as a finished thing.
And also, I was really scared when I was doing it because, you know, you always wonder, is this project too old? You know, is it as relevant now as it was in 2012? And, you know, it's still 8 years later. I was like, what's going to be the reception of it now? Like, do people care? Do we need that book? kind of thing. But in the end, it was crazy. Like, it sold out in 3 weeks. So it was just like, I guess, yeah, sex is universal.
Yeah, it never gets old. Especially in London, when you can't really go out. So
yeah, exactly. It was a perfect timing. A little bit of kinkiness.
And tell me, so that was your first project as a freelancer. So when you were at Airside, you say you weren't expecting that you'll go freelance. So did that happen quite organically as well?
It happened out of frustration, I think, and ego. Like it often happens. My ego got bigger than me. I think it got to a point where I was doing more and more personal work. We were getting commission where I could really do my style, but the idea of the design studio, it was quite small. We were like, all together, we were like 12, was that it was, you know, it was one boat and nobody's name was on things. And, you know, it was Airside, the Airside name for everything. And also being it was an amazing place to work at and amazing team and colleagues. But it was also, there was a glass ceiling at Airside because, you know, it was never going to be like it wasn't a big agency. Your salary could never go, it could only go that high. Even we didn't have like junior, middleweight or senior designers. So there was no hierarchy. And I felt after 5.5 years that I had done everything I needed to do in that studio. But at the same time, I was so spoiled that I didn't feel at all like working somewhere else. I was like, I'm never going to find an agency that is as good as this. And I thought, okay, and actually I have a portfolio. Maybe, you know, it's a bit like when I did my change from mathematics to, you know, to drawing, kind of thought, maybe I need to give it a shot. Maybe it's, you know, it's there. I need to try it. And so that's what I did from graphic design to, you know, to proper illustration. I was like, I owe myself to give it a try. Because every time I'm doing a print for the shop, it's being received really well. People seem to respond to it. And so back then I decided I was going to go freelance. I think I made one big mistake, which was giving them 6 months notice, which was too much. It was just too much. I was just like, no, I want to be honest. I'm going to go, but in 6 months. And then it ruins the morale. You know, it's weird. It's like people want you gone in a way because, you know, it was quite strange.
6 months is a pretty long time. Yeah. Imagine living with someone over 6 months.
Yeah, exactly. But I was still, I think sometimes I'm too honest. Like I should learn to hide things. I'm not very good at that. So I was very, in a way naive about things. And so I was telling them, I'm going freelance. So I'm going to start taking freelance jobs on the evening to pay for it. And, you know, and I think of course then, you know, I was tired. I mean, I was working every weekend. I was trying to get like every bit of freelance work I could because I didn't have any savings and I knew I wanted to have some savings before going freelance. And so in the end, I'm sure like they, you know, they felt the change in my work. I wasn't that involved. Mm. So the last 6 months were quite difficult, you know, like in a relationship, you know, where it's going sour.
Yeah.
But then everything went well, you know, then I left and was still in, you know, all in really good terms. But yeah, if I had to do it again, I would give them 1 month.
Yeah, because I guess it's just so much harder when you know your mind's onto something else and they know that as well.
Yeah,
it just changes the dynamic little bit, but you still sound really fond of Airside. So that's
I mean they were amazing. Like they were, Nat Hunter was one of the founder, she was my hero for a long time, you know. She's just like, first because she was a woman in the industry, she was extremely clever, a lot of common sense, and all of them, you know, they were special. Like there was something really special going on in that place. We had so much freedom. Like, yeah, it was very, I think it wasn't like any other design studio.
So how did you then find the jump to freelancing when all on your terms?
Wait, I'll close the door because my boyfriend is in the kitchen. He's making coffee. So I saved that cushion of money. So every single project I did was kind of going into my savings account. And the reason I did that was because I knew that the first years were going to be instrumental in what kind of illustrator I was going to become, if any. And so I wanted to to be able to say no to jobs because they were shit. Mm. And so this is why I had that cushion, and I think it really helped because, yeah, I really wanted to choose the kind of jobs I was going to work on. And actually, I got really lucky. I think I got this email from Paul Buckley at Penguin, I think 2 weeks before I left Airside for the Kama Sutra. So that was the first project. Can you design the book cover? So that was incredible. And of course, he had seen the other alphabet, so he knew, you know, he kind of knew what he was going to get. But, that job took, I think, another year to come out. You know, when you do a book cover, it takes another year for it to be released. But I don't know how, but I kind of started getting like small editorial jobs, a lot for women's magazine, because I was drawing a lot of pretty women that I'm still doing sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I guess it was very appealing and for editorial, very badly paid. But I was really happy. I mean, I was, you know, did like a little thing for Vogue UK and I was like super excited. I mean, it was every project was exciting, you know, the new clients. So I never felt I really needed to really, really hustle and look for a project. It kind of came organically. And I think having an agent also helped. And mm-hmm. sending, because I found Handsome Frank like right when I left. And I think this really was a good, you know, it's kind of like the planets aligned because he was, I think they had been starting, him and his cousin, they started Handsome Frank 6 months before. They were doing it part-time. So it was a very young, you know, agent that was really excited about illustration, but they had better deals in a way than the other agents, you know, and it just felt like we were growing together. So I think that really helped in the beginning because they were really motivated. They wanted to get you work. And everything was exciting. We were the same age. So, yeah, I think that really helped.
That's brilliant. And that sounds like another... Sorry.
Can you keep the window closed, the door closed, lady? Thanks.
Yeah. Perfect. That sounds like incredible coincidence as well. Like you say to that you guys like found each other kind of same age, same kind of stage of career, kind of them starting yeah. out, you starting out freelance.
But I guess it's about, I think a lot of it is about having a good radar and following your instinct, you know, having a good instinct because nothing happens really randomly. It's kind of like I was looking for agents. Of course, I emailed the big ones, you know, mm-hmm. I had some chats with some bigger agents. And then it was actually through an ex Airside guy. I think he told me, I was talking to him. And he told me, oh, I have a friend who is with this new guy, Handsome Frank, and apparently they are really nice. I was like, oh, okay, give me that email. I'll email them. And so I was, so if I hadn't sent that email, I would never have been
signed. Oh, yeah, okay.
And I remember that, you know, the other agents, you know, of course, it took them like a week, 2 weeks, you know, to answer. And then some, I remember one of the agents told me, I showed him my portfolio and back then I had all the Airside work. So I had a lot of different styles. I didn't have just what I'm doing. And I remember all he was interested in was the Kama Sutra and the, you know, the erotic negative space kind of alphabets and mm-hmm. ladies. And he was like, we can sign you, but we only want that job. We only want that work. This is how we're going to sell you. And back then I wasn't ready to give up on everything else. So I felt like, no, that's not, I don't want to become the girl who draws erotic alphabet for the next 10 years. It's boring. And also I didn't feel the guy on a personal level. I just, you know, didn't like him very much. And coming out of a family and people who were super nice at Airside, I needed to find a nice agent, which is really hard because to be a good agent, sometimes you have to be a bit of a dick. So I think finding someone really lovely I was asking a lot. And John, he answered my email in the next 10 minutes. You know, I sent him an email with a few pieces of work. He said, when do we meet? And when we met, he was super excited. He was just like, yes, yes, yes. You know, we love it. And we love everything. They were a big fan of Airside as well. So I think mm-hmm. also all of that helped. And I just loved the guy. You know, we met in a coffee shop and they didn't even have an office. I think he was working part-time at Creative Review at that point. Just like, I really like the guy and this is how it started. So I guess it's about having your antennas, you know, kind of out there and not going for the, you know, the bling you know, kind of status agent all the time, but sometimes just finding people that are right or is a right fit for you.
Yeah, and that's brilliant because that means you can't quite plan it kind of long term, but you have to in every moment be looking around, feeling what's happening to respond to it.
Yeah, but I guess that's how it's funny. It's like a lot of people tell me that I'm very lucky. And it's true. I've always felt very lucky, like a very lucky person. But also, I think that sometimes luck is just seeing opportunities. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's also about that. It's like you're meeting someone, you're seeing an opportunity without being an opportunist, you know, without trying to, but just seeing that there is a, you know, there is a little door, you know, there is a door slightly open there and you could try it. And if it doesn't work, there is another one. And eventually that's how, I think that's how I built my career generally, like just by seeing these little opportunities and saying yes, sometimes to small things and sometimes saying no to other things, you know,
Yeah, I find it really interesting that you said when you were starting out that you had a buffer so that you can say no to the jobs you didn't want, so that from the start you can establish a certain feel for what you do, which I think it's bold, but it's a really great thing to do.
I think I think it's also because I was, by that point I was 28, so I wasn't starting out, and also I had worked in a design studio for a long time, so I knew that, you know, some clients were not easy, some jobs were not easy, and also the way I felt was that, you know, when you're an illustrator, you're as good as your last project, and also you're always going to be commissioned for what you put out there. So if you start doing, you know, bad work, or it's going to show, and it's going to bring, you know, bad quality work. And I think I was always, also I didn't have a huge portfolio. I had a very small portfolio. So in a way, I felt that every single project I took on, I had to be able to show it. I had to be able to, at that point, I didn't take things, you know, just for the money or thinking, I'll just be paid to do that and then I'll do something nice for myself. No, I wanted, you know, to be paid to do something nice. And even if it was, I wanted to have more projects paid, maybe not as well, but to really build my portfolio. And I worked like a maniac.
And at the time, what kind of work did you want to have and do then? And versus kind of over the past, say, 5-10 years, what kind of work do now?
Back then, yeah, it's constantly evolving. I mean, the style of the work is always the same, but I think it has evolved quite a lot. I remember one day I was still at Airside actually, and I met this designer guy, Thomas Manns, and working on a project which has but 3D project which has nothing to do. And he told me something that I'll never forget. He told me, "You have to remember that you're going to be the first one to be bored by your own work." You know, for other people, it might be the first time they see it, but you've seen it 100 times, but they don't know that. And so basically what I remember from that, so it was really true. And what I remembered from that is if something works, people are going to ask you to do it over and over and over and over again until this is all you do, until you become the girl who draws horses, you know, or pretty ladies with hats. And then for the same reason people love you, they are going to start losing respect for you because she can only draw hats. You know, it's a weird, vicious circle. And I think I understood that really early in my career. And I was like, okay, so now I've done 10, 15 projects for women's magazine, and I've drawn beautiful ladies in Dior dresses. And like, okay, I need to do something else now because otherwise that's all I'm going to be doing. I think I was always scared to be, you know, to become a one-trick pony and to be stuck in something I didn't want to do. And so I think very early what I decided, because I was like, okay, this is the kind of jobs I'm getting now. I can't ask clients to commission me for something else because they don't know what I can do. And so what I did at that point is I started working on my first exhibition. I said, the only way to do that is through personal work. And so at that point, I wanted to do things that were more abstract, more conceptual, and kind of a little bit more daring and edgy, you know, than working for women's magazine. And this is how I, when I did the Hide and Seek exhibition. And so I approached the chemistry gallery, I approached, you know, a few galleries, sent the work, and, you know, told them, that's it, I've got 11 pieces, can we do an exhibition? And chemistry said yes. And so that was my first exhibition. And after that exhibition, which was, I think, 6 months, maybe a year after I went freelance, I think it had been a year. And that first exhibition brought me a lot of work that was related to that exhibition, much more like minimal op art, you know, black and white patterns and stuff. And this is when I realized, that's it, I found the magic formula. If I want to do something else, I have to start doing it for myself. And eventually, I'll get commissioned for it. So I think it's so I've always kind of done that. And slowly, the kind of projects I've done have evolved, and the kind of clients I had. And I think you can't go back. Like, now I still get some emails about doing some illustrations for, you know, beauty magazines or fashion or, but I can't really do it. It's kind of, for me, it's in the past. I'd much rather do a cover for The New Yorker, much more exciting.
Mm-hmm. So talking about covers of The New Yorker, tell me about your, and the listeners, about your most viral cover.
It's Operating Theater. Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, that definitely was the viral one. Did not see that coming at all. Yeah, that,
tell
was,
me
I mean,
about
that
what
was amazing.
The brief. Yeah, what was the brief? So, what were your ideas?
You're going to laugh when you're going to hear the brief. So sometimes The New Yorker, they have like theme cover, which could be like, you know, fashion, could be reading, you know, fiction cover, but they never have a brief. You can do anything you want. You know, you can propose ideas, and if they like it, they'll print it. So my brief, so this one was the first time they were doing that specific thing. They wanted an issue. They were going to do an issue which was centered around my brief, which was health. I thought, was it medicine, health, and the body, something like that. That was my brief. And as often with The New Yorker, you either take inspiration from what's happening around you, or when you don't know, when it's so vague, as a general thing, what I do is I take inspiration from my personal experience, what happened to me, or something I feel people will connect to. And for this one, I really didn't know what to do. I proposed a few different ideas. And the specific one that became the cover was this memory I had, you know, from my operation when I was 6, because I was born with a strabismus. I don't know you call that. My eyes were like completely crossed. And I got operated on when I was 6, which was quite late. And I remember it vividly. And I remember that moment of going under the anesthesia. And, oh my God, you know, it's like as a 6-year-old kid, it really stuck with me. And I think because it's a point of view that so many people have been through, they responded to it, like it really talked to them. But also, I was operated on by a woman. And this is why, you know, kind of, my first sketch was, you know, very roughly this kind of four very similar women around me. And then when I developed the sketch with Françoise, I actually questioned why I only did draw women, you know. And so I proposed the sketch where it was a mix. And actually she told me, no, much prefer it when it was all women, keep it that way. And I think that was the original idea. And sometimes it was kind of subconsciously, you know, I didn't mean it as a feminist cover I didn't mean it as what it became. It just, I think, came from a very personal and genuine experience. But then it hit the right spot at the right time with the right woman, because it's true that it's an industry where, you know, there is a massive gender bias and in general, you know, men are like, doctors are portrayed as men and nurses as women. We're still there, you know? So I think in a way, the reason it became viral is totally thanks to that woman surgeon, Suzanne Pitt, who, you know, was at she was at a conference at that point when she saw the cover, and she really saw it for, you know, what she thought it was, which was, you know, this kind of empowerment cover for women surgeons. And so she's the one who started the New Yorker challenge and to say, you know, telling other women surgeons, take a picture of, you know, the woman team in that exact position and reenact the cover. And then just the images kept on coming. Like, I think we had more like than 5,000. I don't even know, like I've lost count, from every single country. And it was such an easy scene to redo, you know, because everybody had that operating light, and you know, yeah. So it became.
Yeah, how did it feel?
It was amazing. It was an amazing feeling. It was an amazing feeling, and also it's. I think this is when I realized, because I had done a few New Yorker covers already. I had done the Bob Dylan one, which also went viral for other reasons, but it really made me realize that what an amazing platform the New Yorker was, you know, because this is really a place where you can express personal ideas and kind of have an impact, you know, because you know, so many people see it. You can really express personal and important things, you know, things you believe in. So I think that's when I realized, like, okay, my work can touch people, and maybe I can talk about things that are important to me. Maybe it can have, you know, a little bit of a political message, which it never had before, or not consciously. It's like, but I think after that, I started looking at the pieces I was doing in a more conscious way. And kind of, maybe here there is an opportunity to do something, you know, instead of, I remember when I did a textile pattern for a swimwear company based in Barcelona, Arels. And it's a perfect example of the before and after, because before the New Yorker, I would have done a really pretty pattern for swim shorts and I wouldn't have thought twice about it. And that's it. But it came after, and I was like, okay, I've got an opportunity to do something maybe a little bit different. And in the end, I ended up doing a pattern of men kissing men kissing women, kind of like in a really hidden way. And I didn't need to do that, but I felt, okay, there is an opportunity to talk about something, or, you know, to do something that has a little bit more purpose than just a pretty pattern with birds and flowers.
Mm. And do you feel like that's something that's important in the work that you do right now?
It is. It is definitely always, I mean, something, it's more important in the type of projects I take on, you know, like, but I still take on both. I don't want to just do that as well, because then the pressure is just too much. But, you know, like right now I'm working on some, you know, beautiful windows, you know, that are going to be really lush, but on a properly aesthetic level kind of thing, something that makes you happy when you look at it. And then on the other end, I'm going to work on a book, on illustrations for a book about women empowerment. So I think it's about finding the balance, and I need the work, a lot of the work I do, to have some kind of purpose, but not only. I like to have, you know, to talk about movies and to talk about, you know, other things. And, you know, I think for me, it's all about the balance.
Mm-hmm. And with the balance as well, what's your balance when it comes to commercial work and your personal work right now?
The balance has changed massively.
Is personal work still important? Yeah.
No, for sure it is. I mean, I've been non-productive this year. I really need to start doing more. But in a way, the Kama Sutra was personal work. And I'm doing, like, I'm now working on a lot of small collaborations. You know, with people who do stuff I love, also thanks to the, you know, the other Instagram accounts that kind of helped me put me in touch with people. So I want to do some fun things. So it's not personal work, but it's kind of like, you know, like doing a wine label and then being paid in wine. For me, that kind of is personal work almost. But then I think the commercial work has massively, massively reduced for me. I mean, so lucky to be in a position like that. So what I do now is I'm going to try to take like 5 projects a year that, you know, pay the bills, and also are nice. And then the rest, I'm going to try to focus on projects that are more fun, you know. But the ideal is to have both, but I think my tolerance levels have gone down over the years, you know, for clients and feedback and yeah. And also another weird thing that happened is that with, you know, the evolution of social media, I think what I started to find is that a lot of people now are almost more interested in my Instagram following than in my work, which is really creepy.
Yeah, so how do you find that? That's really strange, right? Well, not probably really not strange creepy. Now, but that has... Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not creepy. I can understand. But it's just like, you know, if you could have an illustrator, if you could have an illustrator and a free PR agency, why not? You know, so I think it's kind of, I really need to read in between the lines of the brief and to really to understand that the client wants me for what I do, you know, and not just to post things. And, you know, it's kind of, it's a tricky thing. Like I get more and more emails about like doing influencer campaigns.
I see. Yeah.
Yeah, which is a big no-no for me. Wait, we keep getting the noise. Sorry, you'll have to edit that.
That's okay.
Always with podcast. Yeah, it's a delivery room. Yeah. No, yeah. So I mean, it's normal. It's the world we live in, I guess. So and I, you know, it's my personal choice. Like I can't complain about that, and I'm not judging illustrators while doing it. I think it's a, you know, it's another stream of revenue, and you know, why not? But yeah, for me it's another world. Like I really want to do good work, you know, with nice clients. Mm-hmm. That's the objective. And then eventually maybe not have any clients. Who knows?
And that actually leads me to the last question about freedom.
freedom, and, my dear, dear freedom.
And I've read somewhere, I think, about your family and their impact on your notion of freedom. And now we're talking about the world maybe of no clients and kind of saying no to certain things as well. So I was wondering if we could finish off on your thoughts on freedom, on creative freedom. I think freedom to work from wherever you want. And
yeah, I think freedom is such a wide concept. I think it's, of course, there is creative freedom. There is freedom of movement as well. And I think it's, you know, like what I was telling you about growing up is, so I was this kind of like very materialistic kid in a way. I think coming from almost like hippie parents, that was kind of a way to develop myself, you know, against their beliefs. But my entire dad's family is, they're all bonkers. Like they're all eccentrics. They're all extremely free-spirited minds, like all of them. You know, one lives in Mexico, the other one in Corsica, the other one in La Réunion. You know, they are adopted kids, and you know, my uncle is, you know, gay and married in Mexico. I mean, it's just like it's this, and the whole family was like that. My grandparents were like that. You know, my grandma was cycling in bras, you know, in Paris, because she didn't like, she liked the freedom. She was just like and so I think they all, my grandparents are really the ones that instilled that in their children. And even though my granddad was a businessman, so he was actually quite he was a very successful man. And his kids were like the least materialistic people, you know, ever set foot on this earth, including my dad, probably the biggest one of them. And so I think growing up with that, I loved it. It gave me a lot of freedom to think as well, and having this approach, for example, to sexuality, which later, you know, led me to the Kama Sutra and all these erotic drawings. Like it's something that was never a taboo. It's something that, you know, when I was drawing naked girls that when I was 10, my mom was very happy. You know, she wasn't thinking it was weird. Or so I think all these things that I had in my upbringing really led me to be kind of an independent and free spirit. And for a long time, I thought that money was the goal. And when I actually started to have money, I realized that it wasn't. Like, I realized actually this is not what motivates me. It's not. It's great. But I saw it as this is a way to buy your freedom. I'm buying my freedom with that money. But it's a drug. The more money you have, the more money you want. And then you end up in a lifestyle that you need to afford and you need to maintain. And for me, this is prison. And so I realized after a while that I started earning more money than my friends, but then I couldn't do more things than my friends because I would have to do it on my own. You know, I had no friends who had this kind of money. So this is when I really realized, no, this is good. This is enough. So then that money that I have is going to buy me more freedom. It's going to, you know, this is how I'm going to say no to more clients. I'm going to pick my projects. I'm going to negotiate my creative freedom. I'm going to decide where I live and travel a lot and not worry about taking 15 weeks of holiday a year. It's okay. It's my choice and I'll pay the consequences. And so when I realized that, I really, I embraced it. And I think I've embraced it since then. It's like, probably some people think I'm a diva in the industry because I say no a lot, or, you know, because I'm not that flexible sometimes. But for me, I see it as I'm protecting my own freedom and I'm protecting my way of life. And this is what makes me happy. And I understand that, you know, some people can get annoyed by that. But yeah, if I want to take 2 months holiday, I'm going to do it and fuck it. You know, and again, if I have to pay for the consequences, I will. But in the end, it kind of, I think it always works out. I think the worst thing you can do is live out of fear, you know, of not having work or not. I think you can make anything work as long as you work really hard at it. Like, I think there is no free lunch, but, you know, it's about the balance, I think. So for me, something I really took from my family and my parents, I really thank them for that.
That's such an amazing thought to finish on. And like you said, you know, this is all that works for you, but everybody can have their own version.
Exactly.
Of what they want.
Exactly. And I think it's also having you need to do what doesn't make you anxious. It's like... Mm. You know, it's like some people don't need that much holiday. And when they're on holidays, they feel, you know, guilty. Or I think you need to find this middle point where you're happy with the way you live, as long as it's not driven by fear, as long as you don't live, you know, with that fear of what could happen. I think this is the worst enemy of creativity in a way.
Thank you. Thank you, Malika. This is brilliant. And I know that the listeners will be like super inspired now.
Well, let's hope so.
And we look forward to like seeing more work from you, and yeah, I hope that you can really enjoy sun in Barcelona.
Oh yeah,
the restrictions lifting.
I'm going there now. It's calling me. The sun is calling me.
I mean, there's just so much inspiration in this conversation, and I'm very grateful to Malika for being so open and sharing her thoughts on really how to be true to yourself and have a creative career that suits you. And we all have different needs, and Malika is just a great example of not only an incredible artist, of course, but also a person who along the way took many strategic decisions and followed her intuition to shape her path. And if you've enjoyed our conversation, you can of course rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. And rating it takes about 5 seconds, so I'd really, really appreciate it if you did that. And to keep in touch with me in between podcasts, if you fancy doing so, you can follow me on Instagram at Justina Green. And that's it for today. I hope you really enjoyed it, and I look forward to having you here next week. Bye for now.